Sports Beat Extra.
Beat 102-103.
Delighted to be joined by Off the Ball's Cameron Hill as the first major open of the year, the Australian Open, gets underway in Melbourne this Monday. Cameron, thank you so much for joining me. It's a big day, I suppose, a big day coming up for tennis anyways, as we lead into what will be essentially a months-long journey towards that final. Arina Sabalenka, firstly, I want to start off with. She's going into this tournament as world number one, but a bit of controversy surrounding her.
Yeah. We love a bit of off-season, off-court drama in tennis. And boy, we got a couple of doozies over the Christmas break or the winter break. So you might have seen this match, the Battle of the Sexes, it was billed between world number one, Arina Sabalenka, and Nick Kyrgios, who is absolutely not up to his full fitness and is sort of, I don't want to say embracing, but it is, he's sliding into a kind of Joker role, this kind of exhibitionist style. He got, in fact, I think I saw the other day he got rejected for a wild card for the Australian Open, so he's not going to be in Melbourne on the court anyway, certainly not in a playing capacity. But he beat Sabalenka 6-3, 6-3 in this, like, just sham of an exhibition match in Dubai. By all accounts, I didn't watch it now, but by all accounts, just farcical, not just in the golf and how they were playing and the way in which there was very forced banter, but even the presentation of it wasn't particularly good. They were supposedly mic'd up, but you couldn't hear it. It was in a stadium not suited to that type of crowd interaction. And they wanted to build it as, you know, the Battle of the Sexes, reflecting on that 73 match between Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs, but it's gone down like a lead balloon. Iga Swiatek, the world number two, said it had nothing, I don't think it had anything to do with social change or any important topics. There doesn't need to be any competition. It basically saying what we're all saying, the quiet part loud, who was this for? And it was an interesting choice on numerous fronts. I mean, Nick Kyrgios had an assault charge dismissed by a judge after he pleaded guilty to shoving over his girlfriend, an incident back in 2021 that was dismissed in 2023. So him being in a sort of match billed as the Battle of the Sexes was a little bit uncomfortable for people for obvious reasons. And Sabalenka's been on this sort of goodwill tour for most of 2025 after she lost the French Open final to Coco Gauff and was quite ungracious in her comments afterwards, saying, no, it wasn't because she was good, I just made a load of mistakes. I got pelters for that. And then as a result was kind of climbing down and trying to present herself as this likable character, that this is not who I am. She did apologize to Gauff afterwards. And this is kind of undone it again, all that goodwill. I saw she's been complaining about the calendar and the long calendar for WTA and ATP players, which was a big topic towards the end of the year with all those tournaments in the dead heat of China. So she's back on that kind of wagon, trying to curry a bit of favor with some, for want of a better phrase, easy balls. But I don't know, there's something difficult to warm to with Sabalenka. She's kind of like Djokovic in a big way, who we'll come to in a minute, I'm sure. But she wants to be liked, but she's also herself on the court. And there's that conflict between the persona she wants to put out there and her on-court ability, which I particularly find quite hard to warm to. She can be quite aggressive. But anyway, I think she's going to win the Australian Open, is the short of it. Okay,
well, all of that to lead to this. I suppose the main question, and I know you touched on it a little bit, the question of, you know, who is it really for? And I suppose even her actions, like, who are they for? Like, is it really for herself, or is it for the, I suppose, validation of her fellow competitors? Because you mentioned that Coco Gauff incident where she was kind of dismissive of that win, and then on top of that, then afterwards she kind of retracted those statements. Do you think it's her making all those decisions, or is there a backroom team as well that are maybe just missing the mark on quite a few of these sort of PR stunts almost?
I think, like, if you look at her social media work, there's a lot of, I'm trying to warm, this is the Sabalenka you don't see. That's the kind of, that seems to be her strategy when she's doing either press conferences. She seems to be quite warm in press conferences and a bit of fun. I think her Wimbledon semi-final defeat to Amanda Anisimova was quite, it was really, really good. It was enjoyable, and she seemed to tend to see the funny side of it and not take herself, beat herself up too much. But it is that Djokovic thing where you're desperate to be liked. You want to have this status, not just as an incredible player, but also have the fans behind you. And that's why this year is going to be really interesting for Djokovic, actually, because it feels like it might be his last. But with Sabalenka, There's something about her play. Everything, she's so driven, and her aggressive style of with the forehand returns and hitting those winners, but also the unforced errors. Any game or match or point or set that she's involved in, it's entirely within her control is what you get. That's the sense I get, that if I win it, it's totally down to me. If I lose this point, it's because I made a mistake. And I find that just a little, like, there's a slight, you could be more magnanimous and just admit that a player has bested you there and they've just outfoxed you, or that they have something in their repertoire that you don't. There seems to be no attempt to give anybody else credit other than herself, which I find a bit problematic, but that's just me.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Novak Djokovic, and I want to move on to him very quickly. The fitness concerns around him up to this tournament, I know you're talking about this possibly being a swan song, but, you know, he hasn't competed in a warm-up tournament up to this. He also announced that he wasn't going to be playing the Adelaide International because he wasn't quite physically ready to compete. If you're a Djokovic fan, is this a concerning sort of scenario to be in now going into the Australian Open?
Weirdly, no. I think you know that this is probably his last year. Certainly the way he came off very much second best against Sinner and Alcaraz towards the end of the year, at least, shows that he's on the wane, that he's not able to compete with these guys. He's on 24 Grand Slams right now. He wants to be the outright most Grand Slam title record holder. So he's the most in the men's game, and Margaret Court has 24 on the women's side. So he wants that 25th and become this historically, like, indomitable character. If that's the case, and if he's trying to do it this year, it makes absolute sense that he would go all guns blazing for Australia, which is why I wasn't massively surprised that he pulled out of Adelaide. I think he wants to be totally physically fit for this one last charge, because he's won 10 of his 24 slams in Melbourne. He loves the crowd there. He's got a great following. There's a lot of Serbians who live in Australia and who travel over to watch him in this tournament. And if you're going to do it now, if you're going to do it this year, do it now. Do it while everyone else is still a little bit undercooked at the tournament you love the most, so that then, okay, French Open, Wimbledon, US Open, that's my kind of kissing babies, final lap around the track sort of tournaments. As opposed to if he loses this, it's very hard to see him getting in anywhere towards the final in the French Open or Wimbledon. I know he loves Wimbledon, but like, you're knee deep in the season at that point. This is the time to strike. And you would see probably a more ragged, emotional Djokovic as the year goes on if he fails this time, because of the big three of him, Roger Federer and Rafa Nadal, I always got the sense that he'd struggle with retirement the most because he's so close to the record. He's kind of the one that's outlasted the other two. And also, if you know about his love of meditation and how much work he's put into his body is his religion. And the idea of it failing him now will really hurt him. So I just have a feeling that if he's going to strike, this is the time. And it probably makes sense to leave the warm-up tournaments if you don't need them and just go all guns blazing in Melbourne in a couple of weeks' time and get over the line.
It's not going to be an easy one, though. Carlos Alcaraz, I know just before Christmas, he announced that he was splitting with his then-coach, Juan Carlos Ferrero. He'd been coached by him since 2018. How big of a difference is this likely to make on his Open?
It's really hard to know. It's hard to get a read on it. I think there's still speculation as to why it actually happened, because from both Alcaraz and Juan Carlos Ferrero, it seems to have been quite amicable. There doesn't seem to have been sort of a falling out or a massive tension that they would move on. There might be a financial aspect to it between Ferrero and Carlos Alcaraz's kind of academies that they're setting up. Maybe there was a conflict of interest there. I don't know. That's just one theory that's been put out there. But part of it is this Alcaraz trying to one-up Sinner in this arms race that is between the two of them? Because we saw them basically trading Grand Slam titles, particularly towards the middle to end of last season, and that I'm going to beat you and I'm going to come back stronger at Wimbledon and I'm going to come back stronger at the US Open. And maybe it's his attempt at just giving it a clean slate. Like, he's won all his Grand Slam titles while working with Ferrero, but maybe this is an attempt to just go, right, clean break, let's see what we can do. I think I have the maturity now that I can go and win these things on my own. I don't know who he's going to bring in. If I was to pick a completely wild guess, I'd keep my eye on Andy Murray. They seem to get on really, really well. They play a lot of golf together. And Murray coached Djokovic for part of last season and got him to a semi-final in the Australian Open. During that, he beat Carlos Alcaraz in the quarters. So there's clearly pedigree there. And listening to him on the tennis podcast a couple of months ago, Murray didn't rule out a return to coaching at some point. Maybe it's not going to be quite as hands-on as what Ferrero would give him. But I'd be shocked if Alcaraz isn't tapping up Murray to say, would you come on as a consultant maybe? Let's see if we can improve my game and keep up with Jannik Sinner, because he's obviously worked very hard on his game. And I know that, not to spoil what's coming later, but I think he's the nailed on favorite for the men's singles title at the Australian Open.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought it up, because again, I was going to talk about, you know, when you talk about Carlos Alcaraz, the conversation of Jannik Sinner always comes up parallel to it as well. And, you know, that competition between the two of them, is there almost a more added on level of pressure to Jannik Sinner? But from what you're saying, I almost feel like you could also say there's more pressure on Alcaraz now to back up his decision to part with his coach.
Maybe. I think Alcaraz, in his own heart and in the hearts of many, will have a lot of credit in the bank with how he dug out that French Open final and managed to see off Sinner when it really looked like he was on death's door. So I know he lost Wimbledon and he loves Wimbledon, Carlos Alcaraz. He lost the Wimbledon final to Sinner. But the fact that he could do that puts him slightly ahead, in my view, in that rivalry. And Sinner has a lot of pressure outside of the Alcaraz thing. Like, this is the slam. He's going in as the two-time champion. Back-to-back will be... he'll win it for the third time. But this is the slam before which he got, or after which he got his ban for testing positive for colostobol. And that hung over him hugely in 2025. He was sort of cast a little bit as the villain of the piece in the Alcaraz-Sinner rivalry and dynamic. So he's got a bit to prove, and he's got to go and prove and put that behind him. And what better way to do that than to lift the men's singles trophy in Melbourne. So there is a bit of pressure on the pair of them to keep up with each other. There's probably less and less pressure on the rest of the tour to try and keep up with them at this point, because it's sort of like, what's the point? They're just way further ahead than everybody else. And I don't know if anyone reels them in this year. I think if you're a trophy engraver, you're probably getting a head start on writing one of their names on the trophies in the Grand Slams, and probably a few ATP titles, whatever ones they're in, because, yeah, it's hard to see past them again this year.
Mm-hmm. We mentioned Coco Gauff earlier. I know Sabalenka is your favourite for that side of the tournament, but, you know, poor 25 for Gauff. You know, what can she realistically hope to get out of this Open this year?
I think Jerry Gilroy always says that the Australian Open almost shouldn't be a slam because it's so early in the season. And when you look at sort of the record of some of the top players at the moment, you can kind of see what he means. It seems to come very early for them to really begin to peak. Like, when you consider that the French Open happens at the end of May, that's a huge gulf between the two first slams of the year. So Gauff has, you know, she's never quite shot the lights out at Australia. Iga Swiatek hasn't either. Everyone's going to try and catch up with Sabalenka this year. She's world number one. She feels like she's gone into the year as the favorite to win all of them. Now, I know hard court is her specialty, so it's probably likely that she will win Australia and the US. Gauff won the French Open and in 2025. That, I don't want to say that gives a distorted view of her year, but it probably does. She didn't really match those heights in the rest of the slams. So, and she is the marketable force, much more marketable than even Alcaraz. Tennis wants Coco Gauff to be successful because, God, the endorsement deals and the eyeballs that will be brought to the sport as a result of her doing well because of the sort of the nature of her play, how young she was when she came through initially. And if we're being cynical, the association that people have with the Williams sisters with her for reasons we don't have to go into, there's an obvious marketable force there. So they want her to be successful. And I'm wondering if that pressure is maybe getting to her ever so slightly. But we'll have to wait and see. You know, it's very early in the season. We will probably have more of an appreciation for that as 2026 rolls on.
Obviously, another exciting return is Naomi Osaka. I know, like, from reading her comments coming up to this Open, she's has massive expectations for this, doesn't she?
She does. She does. And she was a surprise package in 25, and that I kind of flagged that I think she might be coming back into the picture. And a lot of people disagreed, and she did so. Now, she did so in a slightly unlikable way. She was, she's the serious competitor again, whereas everyone had a lot of sympathy for her after her mental health struggles and her pregnancy and wanted her to get back to the big time. And then we forgot how much of a competitive animal she can be and how that can sort of, she champions that over maybe, if we go back to the Sabalenka thing, being a likable presence on the tour. There were some interesting comments I can't remember right now, but I found her a little bit harder to warm to this year or last year as a result. And you want players like Osaka, and you want that women's tour to be as robust competitively as possible. Like, Amanda Anisimova was a great surprise last year, and we did think that maybe Wimbledon was her flash in the pan because she got bageled in the final against Iga Swiatek, just didn't turn up, but then played much better in the US Open final against Sabalenka. She did lose in straight sets, and then lost in three sets to Sabalenka in the WTA finals. So it does feel like she's not going to have a sort of Paolini flash in the pan type year, that maybe she's here to stay, which is great for women's tennis, because we have, I know we mentioned Sabalenka and Swiatek and Goff as the big three. There's been no big three really in women's tennis, because it's so competitive and it's such a great field to watch. Elena Rybakina won the WTA finals. She looked like she might have been a busted flush in 25. And I know there was a piece around her coach, Stefana Vukov, coming back, and the unease at which that put a lot of people, particularly in the women's game. But she seems to be roaring back into it. Madison Keys is the defending champion, which I completely forgot about. She's the world number 7, you know, and that's a whole year ago. Like, so it just shows that anyone could be anyone on the women's tour, which in many ways makes it more of an attractive product than on the men's team, where you're kind of just waiting for the final at Grand Slams at the moment.
I know you've mentioned, and I have down here any predictions, but you've already kind of given them Carlos Alcaraz for the men's and Aryna Sabalenka for the women's. Who would you like to see?
Oh, no, I think...
Oh, go on, okay.
I think Sinner, if I'm a pragmatist, he's going to win it. He won it last year. Alcaraz, this is the one he's always struggled with, and kind of... he's slow to wake at the start of every gear, and then he'll burst into life. So if I'm being pragmatic about it, I'd say Jannik Sinner. If I'm romantic about it, and depending on how the draw goes, particularly if Djokovic finds himself on Alcaraz's side of the draw because he beat him in the quarterfinals last year, I could so see a Sinner-Djokovic final, and maybe Djokovic just edging him in that, just on pure adrenaline alone and getting over the line and doing all those interviews for the next year or so of how great a career it's been, et cetera, et cetera. I could totally see that happening, but the realist in me sees Jannik Sinner. And yeah, I think it's Sabalenka's to lose. She absolutely loves hard court tennis. She's so, so good, especially when it comes to Australia. She seems to be quick off the mark at this Grand Slam every single time. So yeah, kind of boring predictions there, but look, it's only January, February. Tennis season is still yet to get up and running.
Absolutely. Well, still good to have an Open to enjoy this early on in the year. Cameron Hill, thank you so much for joining me. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks.
Sports Beat Extra. Beat 102-103.